Good morning. This is August 21st, 2007. We're at the Milltown Dam. This is Miney Smith and Caitlin DeSylvie, and we're doing an interview with the at the Milltown Dam just before it's taken down. So if you two could introduce yourselves and give your name and where and when you were born, that would help us set the stage.
Well, I'm Bill Scarborough. I work for Northwestern Energy. And as to where and when I was born in 1938 in Pratt, Kansas.
I'm Mike Hankey, and I'm an operator here in, work for a contracting firm for Northwestern Energy. But anyhow, I was born in Harrison, Michigan, May 7th, 1943.
Great. We just wanted to start off by getting some background on how long you've been working for Northwestern and sort of how you got hooked up with working here at the Milltown Dam. So, Bill?
Yeah, go first. Let's go here first.
Shortly after Northwestern bought out what was left of the Montana Power Company, they were looking to find somebody with background in hydro operations and maintenance. I was currently contracting through an organization, and Northwestern happened to contact that organization to see if they had anybody, and they called me and asked me, instead of driving all the way back to Washington State, would I be interested in stopping in Montana?
And so, what year was that?
Excuse me, can I shut this
door?
But they made a job offer to me to come in here and oversee this plant, since Northwestern had no one that really knew anything about hydro operations, and this was the only facility they had. So I was brought in here to basically do that, as act as foreman over the facility, as long as Northwestern still had responsibility for the property. Once that's completed, then I go away.
And what year was that you started? Just
I started here September of 2002.
Okay. And there was two guys, Bill and another man, that worked here, and he was a young fellow. And when they found out for sure that this dam was coming out and his job would go away, he decided to leave and find another job before that happened. So Bill, I worked with Bill years ago in a big coal fire plant, and he knew where I lived and everything, and knew that I was just recently retired, and asked me if I'd be interested in a possible job over here. And I said, well, yeah, I'd like to come over and talk about it. So I did, and they hired me, and I've been here for since, about a little over 3.5 years.
Who did you take over from? So Northwestern didn't have anybody who knew this plant. The Montana Power employees must have taken their retirement when?
All the hydro department, with the exception of Milltown Dam, was sold off to Pennsylvania Power and Light Company. That was all the, like, Madison, Hauser, you know, Holter, all the original Montana Power Company hydro system. And the young man that was referred to, Scott Doherty, when it was found out for sure that he had just a short time left before this went away, he was offered a job at Hauser. And so he went to work for Pennsylvania Power and Light Company as an operator there at Hauser.
Okay.
So he followed... He had followed Emmett Smith. What was the transition between?
Back when Emmett Smith was here and he took his retirement, Guy Engelbretson came in as foreman. Following Guy, it was Rod Stewart. And then when Rod Stewart transferred to one of the other dams, Ken Estep came to work here as foreman. And then when Ken left, that's when I came in as foreman.
So what kind of work is involved in running a facility like this? Is it mostly maintenance of, or is it?
Well, the maintenance work we've done since we've been here has been minimal, simply because the plant was known it was going to be being shut down, so the company wasn't going to be putting a lot of money into doing any major repairs. You know, they'd never get their money back from it. So our job was just taking care of relatively minor maintenance work around here, and then just overseeing the operation of the turbines and generators. A lot of that entails shutting down the machines and going into the turbines and cleaning out the trash that comes down river and gets hung up in the turbines. And when that happens, that cuts the load output on the turbines down real fast. And so we had to do a lot of cleaning of the turbines.
How often would you have to do that?
It spring of the year with spring runoff, it would happen maybe once a month. The rest of the year, as things went on, we might be only every 2 or 3 months we'd have to open one of them up and clean them out. But most of it's these little short beaver sticks, you know, how they cut the willows and the alder branches and that for their winter food. And then the little sticks would, in the river, come down river and get through the protective trash grates and go in and hang up in the turbine blades.
That was kind of a fun job. You'd open up a hatch and it's, you know, all dark, and then you drain it down and put a light, check for oxygen, and then we'd both go in, and you'd never go in alone. You'd have two people so that something happened, because you could get caught in there and not get out or something. But anyhow,
because you're actually in there and the workings of the...
Well, I mean, it's not moving or anything, but you crawl inside and you crawl around, and it's not a lot of room, so you kind of...
What's it smell like in there?
Kind of rivery.
Would you have somebody outside just in case something happened to both of you inside?
Well, no, we would both be... I mean, one of us might be outside where one of them was in, or we both would be in, but we'd always have two people. You'd never go in or do it by yourself, because if something happened, you wouldn't be anybody around to drag you out or call 911 or whatever.
Were there ever stranger things that you found caught up besides beaver sticks?
Well, outside we found some...
Out in the trash racks we'd find whatever people threw in the river. But in the turbines themselves, no, it was mostly wood debris, you know, organic stuff.
But coming down the river you'd find deer, bear, a refrigerator once, a whole refrigerator, just most anything that would float.
Were you here when the bear came down?
He was. Bill was.
When was that?
No, that not a bear.
I thought, a black bear. A black bear, you told me.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I've drunk so much stuff out, I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
I've taken pigs out of there. Everything you could think of, you know, that... You know, whatever dies and falls in the river, you know, or gets thrown in the river, we catch it here.
What do? Call Fish Wildlife Park and say, come get the pig?
No, we just drag it around and flush it on down the river.
Oh, that goes down the other side?
Anything that naturally is in the river would go on down. We'd pull out
man-made material,
man-made stuff we would take out, but anything else, just...
If it's natural, organic kind of things... it gets passed on downriver. The plastics, the pop bottles, all that kind of stuff, we pull out and throw in the trash.
Bathing suits, whatever. You find everything, you really do.
Life jackets, life rings.
Canoes.
Paddles. Yeah.
Another thing that we would do is when the generators are running and, you know, something could happen and trip them offline, so we had an alarm system that we'd get called and come back. You might come out in the middle of the night and put the generators back on, which is kind of fun sometimes. And or we have intrusion alarms, any kind of motion anywhere within the dam area, there's alarms all over, like that one on the wall there. When we turn them on, any motion will set them off, so we get called out for that, and usually it's a bird or something, a big heron or something, but every once in a while it was a person. You know, or persons that shouldn't have been here.
Well, you mentioned. Okay. So, what kind of work is involved in running a facility like this? Is it mostly maintenance of, or is it?
Well, the maintenance work we've done since we've been here has been minimal, simply because the plant was known it was going to be being shut down, so the company wasn't going to be putting a lot of money into doing any major repairs. You know, they'd never get their money back from it. So our job was just taking care of relatively minor maintenance work around here, and then just overseeing the operation of the turbines and generators. A lot of that entails shutting down the machines and going into the turbines and cleaning out the trash that comes down river and gets hung up in the turbines. And when that happens, that cuts the load output on the turbines down real fast. And so we had to do a lot of cleaning of the turbines.
How often would you have to do that?
It spring of the year with spring runoff, it would happen maybe once a month. The rest of the year, as things went on, we might be only every 2 or 3 months we'd have to open one of them up and clean them out. But most of it's these little short beaver sticks, how they cut the willows and the alder branches and that for their winter food. And then the little sticks would, in the river, come down river and get through the protective trash grates and go in and hang up in the turbine blades.
Well, that was kind of a fun job. You'd open up a hatch and it's, you know, all dark, and then you'd drain it down and put a light, check for oxygen, and then we'd both go in, and you'd never go in alone. You'd have two people so that something happened, because you could get caught in there and not get out or something. But anyhow.
Because you're actually in there in the workings of the...
Well, I mean, it's not moving or anything,
turbine.
But you crawl inside and you crawl around, and it's not a lot of room, so you kind of...
What's it smell like in there?
Kind of rivery.
Would you have somebody outside just in case something happened to both of you inside?
Well, no, we would both be. I mean, one of us might be outside where one of us in, but or we both would be in, but we'd always have two people. You'd never go it or do it by yourself, because if something happened, you wouldn't be anybody around to drag you out or call 911 or whatever.
Were there ever stranger things that you found caught up besides beaver sticks?
Well, outside we found some.
Out in the trash racks, we'd find whatever people threw in the river. But in the turbines themselves, no, it was mostly wood debris, you know, organic stuff.
But coming down the river, you'd find deer, bear, a refrigerator once, a whole refrigerator, just most anything that would float.
Were you here when the bear came down?
He was. Bill was.
When was that?
No, not a bear.
I thought, a black bear. A black bear, you told me.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I've drunk so much stuff out, I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
I've taken pigs out of there, everything you could think of, you know, that, you know, whatever dies and falls in the river, you know, or gets thrown in the river, we catch it here.
What do? Call Fish Wildlife Park and say, come get the pig?
No, we just drag it around and flush it on down the river.
Oh, that goes down the other side?
Anything that naturally is in the river would go on down. We'd pull out
man-made material,
man-made stuff. We would take out, but anything else, just
if it's natural organic kind of things, it gets passed on down the river. The plastics, the pop bottles, all that kind of stuff, we pull out and throw in the trash.
Bathing suits, whatever. You find everything, you really do.
Life jackets, life rings.
Canoes.
Paddles. Yeah.
Another thing that we would do is when the generators are running and, you know, something could happen and trip them offline, so we had an alarm system that we'd get called and come back. You might come out in the middle of the night and put the generators back on, which is kind of fun sometimes. And or we had intrusion alarms, any kind of motion anywhere within the dam area, there's alarms all over, like that one on the wall there. When we turn them on, any motion will set them off, so we get called out for that, and usually it's a bird or something, a big heron or something, but every once in a while it was a person, you know, or persons that shouldn't have been here.
Well, you mentioned
to whatever the system voltage is where the generator transmission lines are tied into the regular system. And in its simplest form, that's pretty much how it works.
And so which pieces are going to be saved for this interpretation? I think maybe a generator and a...
I guess they're going to save a generator, and they're talking about part of the turbine, or I'm not sure. It's kind of hard to save that turbine because it's hard to get in and out, but we're not sure just what they're going to... The generator, for sure, they're going to keep one.
What's the little governor thing? Can you explain what that was doing? Because I think they're going to save one of those.
The governor is used to maintain the speed of the turbine. When this plant was built, it was the sole provider of electricity for City of Missoula and the surrounding areas. The original power came from what was originally known as the Bonner Dam, which was taken out a year ago. Following that, then Clark built this facility to provide more power to supply his lumber yard operation, the town of Bonner and surrounding area. And then as things progressed, the City of Missoula was tied in, and so they were supplying Missoula with AC power for the city, as well as DC power to supply for the old electric rail car system that served Missoula and all the way out to Bonner. And the governors, obviously, then, are needed to maintain the 60-cycle frequency for the AC power. And that was the function, is they maintain the speed of the shaft so that, for instance, on these units here, the design of them is such that they turn at 200 RPM. And that was their function, to maintain that 200 RPM so that the frequency of the AC power going out to the public would be at 60 cycles. And it's a simple flyweight mechanism. If the shaft speeds up, those flyweights expand out, shifting a linkage rod that was connected to a hydraulic pilot valve. And through the hydraulic system, it would open or close the control valves to let more or less water to the turbine, and either increasing or decreasing the volume of water spinning the turbine.
Was that fairly advanced technology for 1906, that little governor had to...
Yeah, it was.
It seems like that kind of feedback is a tricky thing to get.
It wasn't anything new, but the way it was used here with these, the pilot valve mechanism and that of the hydraulic system, yes, that was relatively new technology.
No, wasn't one of these governors that was still running here when we were operating was one of the last ones in the whole country of that type?
Oh, really?
It was still in operation, didn't it?
Of the DC exciters.
Oh,
the DC exciters, the governor
exciters?
Mechanism on them, but they were by Woodward Governor Company, which is still in existence now. We were told that that was the last still operating governor from back in the turn of the 20th century. And in fact, as far as they knew, anywhere in the world of any of their governors.
Wow.
So, one of their engineers several years ago stopped by here, and he was rather excited to see it, you know, to see something that was from the turn of the 20th century still in operation.
What kind of oil was that in there that they...
It's a spatial hydraulic oil.
Yeah. And just you mentioned the exciter. How does that fit into the turbine generator transformer link there?
It's just a DC generator that supplies DC power to the generator. It puts a field on the generator. Without that, you couldn't produce power.
You have to put the energy into the system to start to generate it.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay.
To get electrons to move on a wire, you have to either pass the wire past or sweep a magnetic force field over the wire, one or the other. Big generators, like these, because when these were built, these were big, big machines, kilowatt output wise. The outer ring of it is called the stator, and that's the permanent windings that connect to the leads to the transformer and so on out to the transmission lines. The rotor part, it has those electromagnets. wound around on it, the big black coils that you see out there on that wheel. And that's the part that Mike was referring to about putting the DC on. And what we're doing is we're creating a magnetic force field in those coils, and by that rotor spinning, we're spinning that magnetic field across the stationary wires, causing the excitation of the electrons to get them to move in the leads.
Great, okay.
So how much power did the dam originally produce, and then when you came, it wasn't producing as much as it originally would? Is that correct? Or?
With Unit 1, it used to be, if I remember right, 3.6 megawatts. But when Unit 1, it developed a bearing problem before I came here, and due to the cost of repairs and realignment of the machine, the company decided that it wasn't worth putting the money into. So when I came here, we just had Units 2 through 5 still operating. And under ideal water conditions, we could get 2.5, 2.6 megawatts out. But on a yearly average, we averaged 1.9 megawatts an hour.
Now, another kind of interesting thing is we're talking about those governors. When we're connected to the grid and on this big grid, the governors, the grid will hold the machine at 200 RPMs no matter what you do to it, unless you disconnect the breaker.
Okay.
So if we stop the water, it would still be spinning that generator. It act like a motor, actually sucking power in rather than putting power out, which is kind of interesting.
Wow. It would keep them spinning.
It would still be spinning at 200 RPM. It wouldn't be producing any power. It'd actually be using power, which is interesting. And then another thing that's interesting is that the more water you put through it, it's making more power, but it's still going the same speed. It's like a car going up a hill. You're giving it more gas, but you're still going the same speed. And that's kind of how that works. You're making more power, but it's still only going 200 RPM. It's kind of hard to understand how that works, but
yeah,
it does.
This isn't a question we have right now, but I'm just kind of curious, like, how did it feel that day when everything got shut down for the last time?
Actually, I think it was an emotional day.
Yeah, it was.
Our life has always been operating them. And then I've got a background in the construction and startup of big thermal power plants. So this was a big first for me to be involved with the actual shutdown and decommissioning of a power facility. And so it's something very different and something this old and of antiquity, it was rather emotional for me, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were recording that too as it shut down, as the H generator shut off, and then we got to the exciters and we closed the gates, but they were leaking through and they wouldn't shut down. It kept barely turning, and I kept telling them, "It's going to stop," but it didn't. Just kept it just barely.
Don't make me stop.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you find it kind of emotional too?
Oh yeah, it's. You know, no one, it was all going to happen. It's emotional, but it was fun too. I mean, it was a really fun day, actually, even though it was sort of sad to see it all shut down and never run again, at least here.
Did you think about yourselves coming out of retirement to put this dam into retirement? Is that?
Well, yeah, that's kind of interesting, really, because.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, we're not quite as old as the dam, but
no.
Well, he is.
Yeah.
So what parts of your job have you enjoyed most working out here? What do you miss?
Oh, I think just the serenity of the place is you know, because like where we used to work in a big noisy power plant and people running all over, and this is so different, and it's just peaceful, and you know, the eagles and the fish and the beavers and everything that you see around. It's for me, anyhow. I mean, I know Bill likes the outdoors too, so it's really a nice place to be.
The people don't, because of the nature that the public can't go into the big power stations, except on special occasions when they're maybe with a tour and that. But the general public isn't aware of the stress level that exist in the big thermal power plants. There are so many different things occurring constantly in there that for the operators particularly, you're constantly under a stress. And everybody's always Monday morning quarterbacking you. You know, because we all know about the cost of electricity that we pay. Well, then you get into these big thermal power plants and you see the enormous budgets it takes to operate and maintain one of those. The amount of pressure that's put on the people there constantly to look after the how the dollars are spent, that there's never a break. There's never a relaxing moment in them. And so coming out of that, and Mike and I getting the opportunity to come here and have our own little world.
It's really nice.
And as Mike says, watch the wildlife around us and everything. Yes, it was just, it was such a dramatic change of work environments.
But, you know, I've known people that have worked in the big power plants and went to hydro and said, man, that's really nice. And I just never realized how nice until I came here.
How well have you gotten to know the area, Milltown, River Bonner, and the people who live there? I mean, is there much back and forth with the community and the dam?
For me at least, you know, that a lot of fishermen used to come down here when they could fish here, and that was, you got a lot of old history from people that, you know, fellas in their 80s telling us about things when in fishing here and doing things way back when, and it's quite interesting. There's a lot of neat people that you get to talk to, or did get to talk to. One old fella, George, great old guy, he'd come down and fish all the time, and he was talking about the contaminants, you know, and said, oh, they say the fish is bad here and this and that. He says, I've been eating them since I was 12 years old. Hasn't bothered me, and he's jerking his head back. He's just really a character. A lot of fun, though. Another old fellow came down and was telling me he used to catch suckers down here for a farmer when he was just a kid. And he's in his 80s now, and the guy would bring them down and drop them off, and he'd catch suckers all day and wheelbarrow them out to a pickup truck, and then the farmer would come home, you know, come in the evening and take them back home and take the suckers and pay them so much for fish. So that's a pretty neat question.
Use them for fertilizer.
Is that what he's doing now?
Yeah. Fertilizer for his fields.
Huh. Were you here for any of the moving the fish from the bottom below the dam up to the top?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got in working with Dave Smetterling and the other fellows from the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks group, doing the trapping out there in the Radio Gate Bay and helping them tag them and implant radio transmitters in them for tracking later on and that. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun with Dave and the guys doing that.
On a good day, they'd have maybe 200 trout trapped in there and thousands of suckers, and they would take the trout out, and then we'd just open the gate and watch the suckers, poor suckers, back downstream.
No. They were going to just pick the trout out.
Yeah, because they were just interested in the trout. I mean, that's what their study was and everything.
Yeah. How
long did that go on for? I think Dave started his first studies here in 2000, 1999 or 2000, somewhere in there when he first began his study of the move. What he was trying to identify was the trout as they came downstream, went through, and then during migration season come back upriver. And he was identifying how the fish will home in because the water, you know, the scent of the water is what they track. And he was identifying how the fish that were trying to get back up the Blackfoot to their spawning grounds, they'll come up one side of the river, and the fish that are trying to go up the Clark Fork, they'll go up the other side of the river. Mm-hmm. And so through his studies and charting all of this, he was able to identify that had the dam been kept in place, it was going to require two fish ladders because they did not intermingle out there. The ones, because the way the flows come in, most of the Blackfoot water is what actually comes through the powerhouse during normal operation. Most of the Clark Fork water would go over the spillway in that way, and so consequently the separation of the two groups of fish as they would come up river. So they would have wound up having to build a fish ladder over here on the north abutment wall area for the fish trying to get up the Blackfoot, and one up along the south part of the spillway for the fish trying to go on up the Clark Fork.
Wow, it would have been like a fish water park.
The other fish wouldn't come over. The Blackfoot fish wouldn't, or the Clark Fork fish wouldn't come over to this side, and they'd just be hanging over there, and they still wouldn't go upstream, just the Blackfoot fish, you know, on whichever side. So,
did you have trout collecting underneath the powerhouse then?
Yeah,
probably. Anywhere there was flow, they tried to go up.
Dave Schmetterling and his group of people, they did a tremendous amount of research work, and he's written several papers, or I say several, he's written papers on this, and he's been printed in notable magazines about his research work on the fish migration through this area.
Yeah, I've read several in Montana Outdoors, a magazine that Dave Schmerling and Lad...
No-Tech.
Some of those other fish biologists have written, which are really good.
Yeah, it was fun working with those fellows because it gave us a chance to learn something that we'd never gotten exposed to before. And so that was a lot of fun, a lot of interesting knowledge there.
Yeah. But aside from the people fishing, did other people from town?
People just come and look around, and you know, every once in a while you have a good conversation with somebody that was just either passing through or lived around. And in fact, as we were shutting down, there's been people coming around saying, "I've never been in here ever. Could I come and look?" And then some of them, it's too late because like now we can't let people in much, and so they've lived here all their life and never
coming down together.
Well, they've never really had a chance, or you know, never took the opportunity to. They could have, but once it's going out, then there was people that, "Oh, I never got in there. Can I get in there?" In which we did accommodate as many as we could, but then like right now, it's all off limits, and so it's too late.
Did you get people kind of coming down to say goodbye?
A few people. Like one guy brought his young son in. He says, "When it was still operating, still producing electricity, and he wanted to show him." You know, he was like 7 or 8, and whether they remember, I don't know, but that he remembered the Milltown Dam still making power, which would be kind of neat years from now. No, I tell Bill that he'll come by here some time in the future and nothing will be here and there'll be a kid fishing. He says, "Yeah, there used to be a dam here. I used to work there." He goes, "Sure, mister, sure."
Do you get people sort of asking why the powerhouse couldn't be saved? I know that.
Oh, a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how...
Yeah. Well, if the dam was going to stay, there was going to be a lot of money needed to be put into it to do a lot of maintenance work. It's sound for what it was doing, but to allow the public, you know, there's been a lot of suggestion, why didn't they make this into a museum, or what a neat restaurant this would have made down here on the river, that sort of thing. Well, for the general public to come in, there would have been a tremendous amount of money needed to be put into this, bringing it up to a standard that would be safe for the general public to just come and go. Mm-hmm. For us working here, it's not unsafe, but yet there are things here that, had it remained, would have had to have been fixed. And all. But we knew we were on short term, and so there again, we didn't put the money into it because it would have been money spent poorly.
So right now there are just the two of you, but was originally there were four houses, right? So there were more people early on that were needed to run it, or what? Why can it be run?
Was
now?
It four houses or? I think at one time, it seems to me Emmett Smith told me at one time there were four houses because there used to be a superintendent's house and then the foreman and two operators. And then the superintendent, if I remember Emmett correctly, and I wouldn't want my feet held to the fire on this, as the system grew, he was relocated to Butte or something, or in town Missoula, and his house was removed. And so it was just the foreman and two operators that had houses here.
So was it with the automation things that reduced the number of people?
We were just so efficient that they only did.
What it really amounted to was the system was getting so big that the amount of power we were putting out here was getting to be such a small infinitesimal amount that if the plant tripped offline, the system really wouldn't even notice it.
I see.
And so the need for that kind of coverage was no longer necessary. Back in the days when this was a significant percentage of the system power for the surrounding area here, yes, they needed that kind of 24-hour coverage so that whatever happened, they had an operator already on duty. The guys used to work around the clock and to make sure that things were kept going, or if the plant did trip off for some reason, they could get it back online, get it going right away because of the plant being such a major part of the system's output. But there again, as things grew, the country grew, we became smaller and smaller in relationship to the whole.
Yeah.
So, you know, this last few years, we would there'd only be one of us here, and then we'd have days when we're together, when I take over the shift, and then, so, but normally it'd just be one guy here, and then he'd be on call all the time in case something happened, but like Bill said, if it took you 2 hours to get out and get the units back on, nobody really hardly knew the difference, so it wasn't as critical.
Dispatchers wouldn't know anything happened except for the alarm horn or the alarm on the computer for them.
Yeah.
So how are you now going about getting things ready for the demolition? What are you up to in these weeks here?
Well, we're moving everything in here up above to, we're moving the office up there until we're gone.
Oh, into that
into the garage.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to move the computer, and we have to redo the phone line and or the computer line so that we can still use that. And a lot of stuff we're taking into division, and transformer guys are taking a lot of the stuff that they can use because, you know, we just don't use it anymore or have any use for it. So
that over the next month, well, like you came in to today, we're busy getting ready to start removing the transformers. We pumped the oil out of them yesterday. Today we'll physically remove two of them. They'll be hauled to the main transformer yard in Butte. Tomorrow we'll take two more of them out. Once the transformers and the circuit breakers for the generators are removed, later on in September we'll get the generators out. That's going to be a lot of heavy lifting work. We'll have to bring in a heavy crane, and part of the building will have to be demolished so that the crane can be able to boom in over the unit area and pick those generators out. So that'll all happen by the end of September. As it now stands, the target date to begin the official demolition of the powerhouse is October 1st. Now, like everything in this project, there are so many ifs, ands, and buts involved with it, any one of which can upset that timetable very easily. So nobody's casting any dates in concrete. Mm-hmm. It happens when it happens.
It's kind of interesting that the manager from Viracon, that he said this section we're in right now will be about 2 hours worth of time to take it down and be gone in 2 hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they'll just come in. You know, there's no value in this whole thing.
So it's just going to...
They'll just come in with a big clamshell shovel. They'll just start taking bites out of it and loading it onto trucks and hauling it away.
Hmm.
And that.
And so you guys are on until what point?
I'm not sure exactly. Well, once we have no... There's no control of the river at all. That we can't control the river in any way, then they have no need for us at all.
So you're the interface between the place, the facility, and the river.
Northwestern's responsibility stops when the river is flowing free on its own. Now that is kind of up in the air. What Mike and I really aren't sure of at this time, because they had to change their plans. Originally, they were going to take the spillway out first, which I'm sure you know you're aware of. Mm-hmm. And then due to some engineering difficulties in doing that and getting it accomplished in the timeline they wanted, they had to shift their plans to take the powerhouse out first. Now, whether they're going to call that allowing the river to run free and unabated by anything, we don't know. Or is Northwestern's responsibility still going to be here until it's back in its original channel, which is over against the south cliff?
Yeah.
So that's one of the things we're not sure of. So we know that we'll be gone by next April, because they have to have the river for sure back in its original channel and flowing free before spring runoffs begin. And so, but how much before April 1st? That's the guessing game.
So what do you think the best way to remember sort of the history of the dam is? For the little boy on the fisherman, you know, that you said when after the dam is gone, the little kid up there fishing.
Oh, I don't know.
What's the best way for them
to understand it and understand what was here? And
just the history from the museum, I guess. And also, have you seen that artist's picture that he made of the dam? Have you seen that?
The ghost
dam.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess he only had 350 copies of that, but that is a neat thing.
Is that the Lani Dola?
Yeah, right. We both got one of those.
Oh, you did?
Good.
They were given to us as gifts by a complete stranger.
Whoa.
Yeah, that was the neatest deal. Yeah.
Shocking, really.
He came out one day, and Bill showed him around, and he worked on turbines all over the country, and he lives here. And he came back later, and he had one of these pictures. He was going to give it to Bill. If Bill wasn't here, I wasn't. He goes, oh, too bad you weren't here. You'd get it one of these. I go, yeah, I'm a lot nicer than Bill anyhow. So we were talking for quite a while, and he left the picture. I said, oh, he'll be so thrilled with that. And then the man said, I'm going to town. I'll be back after a little bit. And I says, what are you doing? He says, I'm going to go get you a print. And I go, oh, I'll buy it. I'll pay for it. Nope. He insisted. He went and brought me a print, which was just super nice.
I was at home, and Mike called, and he says, going to be home this evening. Yeah. He says, I got something for you. Big surprise. What is it? He says, oh, you got to wait until I show you. And he comes driving up, and here he comes with this print. Now, where in the world did this come from? He says, oh, you remember so-and-so, the guy you were showing around in the powerhouse and that? And I said, yeah. He said, he bought this for you. It was totally shocking. You know, a complete stranger do something like that, because those aren't cheap.
No. But that's neat.
But do you think that the idea that's sort of been floating around of having some kind of interpretive
the museum here, up here, that'd be great.
Would that be a good idea?
Yeah. In fact, I hope they get busy and get going on that real soon, because things are starting to happen here, and if they want to save some of this stuff, they've got to get a space prepared up here to store it, and they're going to have to provide some sort of a makeshift building or something to put it in, or people are going to be coming over scavenging.
Yeah.
But things are going to be happening real quick, real soon. So, yeah, that museum that they've talked about, I hope Senator Baucus is able to come up with the money that he said he was going to try to come up with in federal supporting funds for that, because that would be a great thing.
Would you be willing to come over every once in a while and talk to people about if we get it going? It seems like the timeline might be kind of long, and that might be 5 years before there's anything up there.
Oh, you're probably talking closer to 10.
Yeah, it might be. Are there any other stories that you think should be passed on? Emmett had a lot of stories about his time.
Well, during his time here, he would have.
Yeah.
Oh, I got a funny dealing with Emmett Smith. Before they put the concrete and the permanent bridge across the top of the spillway. That was all wooden, what we call drop panels to hold the water back. And to get from one side over to the south bank, that was just a big swinging bridge. I don't know if you were here before 1987 or not. And it was a swinging bridge across there, and that's what the operators had to go out on, because these drop panels, they had to keep the ice busted back away from them so that the pressure of the ice wouldn't knock them down, because they were of a design that once they were down, the river ran free until the following summer when flows dropped down enough that they could get down there and stand these panels back up. So it was very imperative that they keep the ice cut back away from those panels. Well, the guys would go out. Now, this is the days before OSHA and the high level of concern about safety that there is today. They'd go out and they would tie ropes around themselves and lower themselves down from that swinging bridge onto the ice, and they'd take chainsaws and big, large bars with cutting edges on them to cut and break the ice free and move it out of the way. Bill Thompson, the engineer we worked for, he found one of those old pictures of Emmett standing down on the ice with a rope tied around his chest and tied off up to that swinging bridge, and here he is working away with a chainsaw cutting through the ice. Bill decided to have some fun with the safety engineering group in Butte. He goes walking into one of the morning meetings and he says, guys, he says, I got a question here. He says, I'm not sure if somebody needs to do something about this or not, but he says, I'm pretty sure this is not an acceptable practice. And he shows them this picture of Emmett. Of course, there's no date on the picture right. or anything. So little do they know that it's an old picture.
Right.
And they just went ballistic when that safety engineering group saw what was happening. They just went critical. Oh, my God, we got to get over there and put a stop to this right now. You know, then Bill let him in, clued him in what was going on. No, that's all gone today.
Oh,
there was another one of him, Emmett, you know, when the way days passed where they would do big log jam up against the three gates or two mm-hmm. gates they had?
Three.
Instead of this big radio gate. And he was down there, with water was going through it, but he was down there cutting on these logs all jammed up. And I mean, yeah. He had a harness on, but still dangerous as could be. They never will let anybody do that nowadays.
Well, several guys that still work here in the division used to have to come out and help with the log jams. And Doug Amos and some of those guys still tell stories about being out there on that swinging bridge when one of those logs would get hung and kick up on end and hit that bridge, and all you could do is grab hold of the support cables and hang on for the ride.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, pretty exciting.
So what do you think about the cleanup from what you've been able to see and what people have shared with you?
Well, it looks like they're doing everything they said they're going to do. I mean, it's really a big job. And I, working with those EnviroCon guys, I'm really impressed with them. I mean, they're really, I think, doing a great job and really, you know, I mean, really get involved in or doing things the right way, it looks like, which is really nice.
I'm so detached from that over there. What I see from here is pretty much what the general public sees. And the newspapers tell me more about what's going on than anything. EPA puts out a weekly update on that, and that's where I get most of my information on it. But as Mike said, we do work with several of the guys over there, so we have a name and face recognition rapport. And just knowing the caliber of the people they are, it makes you comfortable realizing the kind of guys and the conscientiousness of doing what's right and making sure that things are not getting out of control or anything like that. That it's a comfortable feeling knowing that what they're dealing with is being looked after that way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
So have you run into things in this demolition process that you didn't expect to run into? I mean, has it become more difficult or it's
really, we're not to that point.
Or the decommissioning
in this
process.
Yeah, yeah, we're in this decommissioning of this plant. We haven't run into anything yet that, you know, would you, I could call a big surprise, because we haven't done that fit much physically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here today, this is the first real activity of doing any real decommissioning, mm-hmm. of removing of equipment or anything. And I would say no, we really haven't run into any big surprises.
Well, there were those 20 gold bricks we found.
Well, that kind of wraps up our questions here.
Yeah. Unless you have any other stories or things you'd like to keep for posterity.
No, we really appreciate you talking to us. I know it's
it's a busy time, and
I want to read my poem into this.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Mike and I, we decided something had to be left to be said about the history of the plant. And so one day, just doodling around here, I put together something. And it's titled, In Remembrance of Milltown Dam Hydroelectric Power Generating Plant. Commenced generation, January 9, 1908. The plant kilowatt hour meter records the first electric power generated. Ceased generation on April 7, 2006. The last generator was shut off, forever stopping the kilowatt hour meter. Service life was 98 years, 2 months, and 29 days. Through the thick and the thin, the floods, the ice, and the droughts, Milltown Dam Powerhouse has seen it all and survived all but the perpetual march of time. Time does overcome all, and Milltown Dam will soon be relegated to history. Local museums will put parts, pieces, and pictures of it on display. Articles will be written telling of its place in Montana history, and what a bright place in the history of Montana it has. Almost a century of providing electric power to homes and industry. But alas, the old gives way to the new. So, good and faithful servant, we bid thee farewell. Bill Scarborough and Mike Hanke, the last of the many operators of Milltown Dam.
So, when you flip on an electric switch and light comes on, just remember there's men and women behind that magic.
Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you.